Now, we made a start on the fourth and final section of Zechariah's book, which you remember consists of two oracles or burdens. And we said that the first oracle or burden was mainly concerned with events leading up to Christ's first coming. And we saw in chapter 9 an amazing prophecy concerning Alexander the Great, the first ruler of the Greek Empire, and the prophecy outlined in some detail the events of Alexander's Levantine campaign, when he conquered many cities in Syria and Phoenicia and Philistia on his way to Egypt. And we saw how amazingly that he didn't attack the city of Jerusalem. And this was a fulfillment of verse 8 in chapter 9, where God said, "I will camp around my house," meaning Israel, "because of an army, because of him who passes by and returns." And we saw that Alexander did pass by and he did return. And God obviously camped around his land because and Jerusalem because Alexander didn't fight them. But in contrast to Alexander, who was proud and cruel, verse 9 goes on to tell us that Israel's king is going to be righteous and lowly. He is going to come not on a war horse like Alexander, but he's going to come, he's righteous and endowed with salvation, he's lowly and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a pack animal, or a donkey as most translations say. But the Jews didn't want this kind of king. They wanted someone like Alexander, who could rout the occupying forces, which was Rome at that time, from their land. But verse 10 told us that Jesus, eventually he was going to set up a kingdom far greater than that of Alexander. And Jesus' kingdom, it said, his reign, end of verse 10, will be from sea to sea and from the river, meaning the Euphrates, to the ends of the earth. And if the Jews had accepted him as their king the first time, that promise would have been fulfilled. But they didn't accept him, so it wasn't fulfilled. And now these promises won't be fulfilled until a time in the future. And then from verse 11 onwards, we saw a further prophecy, which is past now to us, but was still future to Zechariah. And this prophecy was about something that would take place again before the first coming of Christ. And we saw in those verses that Greece, who under Alexander had been like one of those craftsmen in Zechariah's second vision, who was a friend to Israel in some respects, particularly in conquering Persia, Greece now takes a turn for the worse, as far as Israel is concerned. And many years after Alexander had died and his empire had been split into four, there came to prominence a ruler over one of the quarters of the Greek Empire, and his name was Antiochus Epiphanes, and he terrorized God's people. And we saw, particularly in verse 13, how God was going to empower the people in the land of Israel to fight against the tyrannical measures which Antiochus put in place in Israel. We read in verse 13, God said, "I will bend Judah as my bow, I will fill the bow with Ephraim, and I will rouse up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece, and I will make you like a mighty man's sword." And all these events are recorded, the outworking of these events are recorded in the historical book of the books of the Maccabees. And God raised up a priest at that time called Mattathias, and he and his sons organized a resistance movement against Antiochus's reign of terror. And when Mattathias died, his third son, Judas, nicknamed Maccabee, which means the hammer, took over the leadership, and eventually the people were able to cleanse and restore the temple which had been violated. So that's what God, he did do. He did rouse up Zion's sons under the leadership of Mattathias and then his son Judas Maccabee against your sons, O Greece, specifically against this tyrannical ruler, Antiochus Epiphanes. So chapter 9 deals with two proud and arrogant Greek political leaders, kings, if you like, Alexander at the beginning of the chapter and Antiochus at the end of the chapter. They're not named, but scholars and commentators recognise that that's who these people, that's who Zechariah, that's who these prophecies are about. These people came to power and were very successful for a time. And the pivotal verse in the chapter, verse 9, contrasts these two powerful men with Israel's true king, who was lowly, who came in righteousness, who was going to bring in a kingdom of peace, but his people rejected him. So now we're going to start chapter 10. We're going to hopefully deal with the whole of chapter 10 today, so we've got quite a lot of material to get through. And in chapter 10, we're going to see another contrast. Instead of speaking about political leaders, chapters 10 and 11 are going to be focusing on spiritual leaders. This time, instead of a contrast between two different kinds of political leader or king, we're going to have a contrast between different kinds of religious leaders, or shepherds, as they're going to be called. And this theme is going to be very briefly touched on in chapter 10. We won't see too much about it today, but in the next chapter it's going to be developed a lot more. So although I'm aiming to look at the whole of the chapter, I'm going to work through it in short sections. So I'm going to ask Phil just to read a bit, and then we'll look at the meaning, and then Phil to read a bit more, then we'll look at the meaning. So could you read, Phil, please, the first three verses only?
Okay. Ask rain from the Lord in the season of the spring, rain from the Lord who makes the storm clouds, and he will give them showers of rain to everyone, the vegetation in the field. For the household gods utter nonsense, and the diviners see lies. They tell false dreams and give empty consolation. Therefore the people wander like sheep. They are afflicted for lack of a shepherd. My anger is hot against the shepherds, and I will punish the leaders. For the Lord of hosts cares for his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them like his majestic steed in battle.
That's fine. Lovely. We'll deal with those first three verses first of all. Now in verse 1, Zechariah tells the people to look to God for their needs. He specifically mentions rain, actually, because in the ancient world, the most basic need was rain, especially in a hot climate like this. If there was no rain, there'd be no harvest, and therefore no food. And pagan religions worshipped deities like Baal, who was the storm god, for example. And the Hebrew word here, rain, is the kind of gentle, consistent rain that penetrates into the soil and does the plants the most good. It's not a destructive thunderstorm that damages the crops. It's rain that would rejuvenate the land, not flood it. And it was the late rain I've got. I think you said spring rain in yours. Mm-hmm. But it's March and April. That's the rain, spring rain, if you like. That was the most beneficial. And in verse 2, Zechariah warns the people about looking to pagan gods to meet their needs. So he said in verse 1, ask God for your needs. Don't ask the pagan gods. I've got teraphim, which is, as the ESV correctly translates, household gods. That's what teraphim were, household gods. They were small carved statues which people kept in their own homes, their own private kind of gods, if you like. And they are often referred to in scripture. Genesis 31 tells us that when Jacob and his two wives, Leah and Rachel, and their children escaped from Laban, Rachel took her father, uncle Laban's teraphim, the household gods, with her, which is quite amazing. Now, we know that there are no other gods other than the one true God. So the entities which were behind these teraphim or household gods were demons. This is why they speak wickedness in my translation, perhaps foolishness, or what did you say, that the household gods speak emptiness, nonsense. Okay. You've got nonsense, all right.
Wicked nonsense.
They give harmful counsel and encourage their worshippers to becoming involved in depraved acts. And during their time in Babylon, the people would have been completely surrounded by this kind of pagan worship. And then Zechariah warns about these diviners. Now, diviners, what they were different. They claimed, say, natural phenomenon. Let's say there was a thunderstorm or hail. They would claim that there was a special meaning behind that quite natural phenomenon. They said that these things were omens, which had a kind of spiritual significance, which they could interpret. And they also claimed to be able to interpret normal dreams and give them fanciful interpretations. But the diviners' claims were worthless. They were false. And therefore, any comfort that they tried to give a person was empty. And therefore, they were false shepherds. These people were false shepherds. The gods, the demons behind these household gods, the diviners who were claiming certain spiritual powers, these two things are false shepherds. And because the people had looked to these things to guide them, pagan gods, and they'd looked to diviners, the people were like sheep. It says right near the end of verse 2, they wander like sheep. And this is not a compliment to the people, because sheep are not very brainy, not very bright animals. They will follow anything. They can't find their way when they're lost, which makes them very vulnerable. And if a sheep is lost, it just keeps aimlessly wandering around. And Jesus said, did he not, when he looked on the crowds, he said, seeing the crowds, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed, like sheep without a shepherd. They were confused. They didn't know where to turn. And the sheep in verse 2 are obviously lost because they're described as journeying or wandering. And they are afflicted because there is no real shepherd. There's no true shepherd. That's what that means. Plenty of false shepherds around who are confusing them. But they are afflicted because there's no true shepherd. But, verse 3, apparently there are some people who claim to be shepherds. And we read about them in verse 3. There are religious leaders in Israel, but Yahweh is obviously not pleased with them because he says, my anger burns against the shepherds. And these shepherds are like the ones in a passage in Ezekiel 34. Let's look at Ezekiel 34. It's quite a famous passage if you ever want to see what God thinks about false shepherds. One to ten. Perhaps Lorna could read that. It's a bit of a chunk, but if you could read 1 to 10.
The word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, even to the shepherds, thus says the Lord God, ah, shepherds of Israel, who have been feeding yourselves, should not shepherds feed the sheep? You eat the fat, you clothe yourselves with the wool, you slaughter the fat ones, but you do not feed the sheep. The weak you have not strengthened, the sick you have not healed, the injured you have not bound up, the stray you have not brought back, the lost you have not sought with force, and with harshness you have ruled them. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and they became food for all the wild beasts. My sheep were scattered, they wandered over all the mountains and on every high hill. My sheep were scattered over all the face of the earth, with none to search or seek for them. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As I live, declares the Lord God, surely because my sheep have become a prey, and my sheep have become food for all the wild beasts, since there was no shepherd, and because my shepherds have not searched for my sheep, but shepherds have fed themselves and have not fed the sheep. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against the shepherds. I will require my sheep at their hand and put a stop to their feeding the sheep. No longer shall the shepherds feed themselves. I will rescue my sheep from their mouths, that they may not be food for them.
Great. Well, that's very powerful passage, and God's saying a lot there. Basically, these shepherds are not doing the job. They are feeding themselves. They're not feeding the flock. They're letting the flock go where they want. They're not searching for them. The flock are completely lost. They're scattered. They're not going and seeking for them. They're not healing the diseased ones. In verse 4, if they've got, these sheep have got broken legs, you're not doing anything about it. You're not binding up their broken legs. You're not searching for them. And also you're judging them with severity and dominating them at the end of verse 4. So very strong words. And these are the kind of shepherds that we have going back to Zechariah. This is the kind of shepherd that God is looking at, and he says, my anger burns against the shepherds. And it says also he's going to punish the male goats. Now, what are these male goats? We won't go into that especially, but this phrase is used elsewhere in Scripture. I did have a couple of references, but I thought we wouldn't look at them because it takes too long. They refer to corrupt leaders, as you can imagine. So the male goats are the corrupt leaders in Israel. And then, in the middle of verse 3, we are kind of propelled into the future. A bit like, you know, a situation that we had in chapter 9. Zechariah is talking about one thing, and then all of a sudden, at verse 9, we're propelled into his future to tell us about Jesus, who's going to come lowly, riding on a donkey. We have something a bit similar here. In the middle of verse 3, we see that Yahweh is going to once and for all punish. I will visit punishment upon the male goats. He's going to once and for all punish these false leaders, and he's going to rescue his flock. And that's because he is their true shepherd. And I know you've all lost your place in Ezekiel now. I should have told you to keep your place in Ezekiel. Ezekiel 34. And we see exactly the same situation from verse 11. So we've had it in Ezekiel 34, 1 to 10, a real description of these false shepherds. And now Ezekiel's going to say something similar to Zechariah. In verse 11 he says, for thus says Lord Yahweh, behold, I myself will seek my sheep and care for them, as a shepherd cares for his herd in the day when he is among his sheep which are spread out. So I will care for my sheep and will deliver them from all the places to which they were scattered on a cloudy and gloomy day. I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries and bring them to their own land. And I will shepherd them on the mountains of Israel by the streams and in all the inhabited places of the land. I will shepherd them in good pasture, and their grazing ground will be on the mountain heights of Israel. There they will lie down on good grazing ground and be shepherded in rich pasture on the mountains of Israel. I will shepherd my flock, and I will make them lie down, declares Lord Yahweh. I will search for the lost, bring back the scattered, bind up the broken, and strengthen the sick. But the fat and the strong I will destroy. I will shepherd them with judgment. So we see there that the Lord himself is going to look after his sheep because he is their true shepherd. And instead now, in Zechariah 10:3, instead now of his flock behaving like silly sheep, which they had done in past times, his people now are going to be, they're going to become like God's war horse. Specifically, it says, they're going to be the house of Judah. Specifically, the house of Judah. It says, for Yahweh of hosts has visited his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them like his splendid horse in battle. So specifically, the house of Judah, which was the royal tribe from which the kings came, that's going to be transformed into a mighty nation with God-fearing leaders. Okay, now Phil, could you read 4 to 7, please?
Yeah. From him shall come the cornerstone, from him the tent peg, from him the battle bow, from him every ruler, all of them together. They shall be like mighty men in battle, trampling the foe in the mud of the streets, They shall fight because the Lord is with them, and they shall put to shame the riders on horses. I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph. I will bring them back because I have compassion on them, and they shall be as though I had not rejected them. For I am the Lord their God, and I will answer them. Then Ephraim shall become like a mighty warrior, and their hearts shall be glad as with wine. Their children shall see it and be glad. Their hearts shall rejoice in the Lord. How far?
To seven.
That was seven.
Yeah, that was seven. Yeah, excellent. Right, so up to now we've seen Israel being like silly sheep, being confused because they're being misled by various false shepherds. And Yahweh is saying, I'm going to step in and I'm going to visit my flock. I'm going to turn them into a splendid war horse. And in verse 4, we have a marvellous description of the Messiah. And God here uses three metaphors to describe him: a cornerstone, a tent peg, and a battle bow. But before we are presented with these three metaphors, we are given a clear indication of the tribe which the Messiah is going to come from. In verse 4 it says, from them, four times. Now who's this? From who? It's referring back to the house of Judah in verse 3. So he talks in verse 3, it says, the house of Judah is going to be made like a splendid horse in battle. And from them, that means from the house of Judah, is going to come a cornerstone. From the house of Judah is going to come a tent peg. From them, from the house of Judah, is going to come this battle bow. And this is a clear prophecy concerning the Messiah's first coming. And it tells us that he's going to come from the tribe of Judah, which many, many scriptures speak about. And we could have had an interesting study on that, but that would have taken us a long time. So let's move on now and look at these three metaphors. There's quite a bit to say about them. First of all, we know that the cornerstone, we've seen this a lot in Peter's letter, he refers to the Messiah being a cornerstone. The cornerstone is a large stone which is laid at the corner of a huge building, for example, a temple, to hold two walls in place at right angles. It is an essential stone in a building because it stabilizes the whole structure. But the people, when Jesus came the first time, as we know, they rejected the cornerstone. They had thrown this cornerstone out. So it was left, as it were, lying on the building site. They didn't want it. They didn't want that cornerstone. And then they tripped over it. They stumbled over it and did themselves great damage. We won't look at the scriptures that say that because we're quite familiar with them in Peter's letter. But because they had rejected the cornerstone to the building, their building had fallen down in AD 70 when the Romans had slaughtered so many Jews and dispersed the rest to the ends of the earth. So we know literally their building, the temple, fell down in AD 70. It didn't fall down, was the destroyed in AD 70 by the Romans. But we know that using the idea of a building metaphorically, the nation, the people, it was also torn down, destroyed, and the peoples dispersed in AD 70 all over the world. But Jesus was going to come and he would have been their cornerstone. He was their cornerstone, but they rejected him and then they tripped over him. Now let's look at this second metaphor, which you may be less familiar with. That's why I've not spent so much time looking at the cornerstone. We could have, but it's a lot of familiar ground. A tent peg, maybe less familiar. There were two kinds of tent peg used in Old Testament times. One was the kind of tent peg we're all familiar with, which you hammer into the ground when you're putting up a tent. But the kind which is the one referred to here was a central pole. I mean, they had big tents in those days, and they had little camping tents that you kind of crawled into. They had big tents that you could stand up in. And they had a central pole which supported the tent from inside, but it was also used to hang things on. I suppose people in our day would hang their car keys on it, probably. But then people would hang important things on the central tent peg. They would hang their pots and pans on it. And maybe they would even hang valuable things there for everybody to see. When their visitors came, they'd be able to be displayed there to their visitors. Now let's turn to Isaiah 22. This is an interesting passage. And Isaiah 22, I'm going to start at verse 15, uses the metaphor of the central tent peg. Now, first of all, we're going to read about two stewards to the king. First, we're going to read about a steward called Shebna in verse 15, who was in charge of the royal household. Let me read verse 15. Thus says Lord Yahweh of hosts, come, go to this steward, to Shebna, who is in charge of the royal household. So these words are addressed to Shebna. What right do you have here? Etc., etc. Verse 17. Behold, Yahweh is about to hurl you headlong, O man, this is Shebna, and he's about to grasp you firmly, and he will surely roll you tightly like a ball to be cast into a vast country. There you will die, etc. Verse 19. I will push you out of your office, and I will pull you down from your station. So, Shebna, the steward, is going to be given the sack. All right, that's the general drift of that. We won't go into each verse. Shebna is going to be given the sack. And then in verse 20, we read that God is going to appoint another man in his place called Eliakim. Let's see how it describes Eliakim in verses 20 to 24. Then it will be in that day that I will summon my servant Eliakim. You know, having given the Shebna the sack, he's going to give Eliakim Shebna's job, important job. Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your, meaning Shebna's, tunic, and tie your sash securely about him. I will give your authority into his hand. And he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one will open. I will drive him like a peg in a firm place, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. So they will hang on him. Remember what I said about hanging things on the tent peg, the central peg? So they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offspring and issue, all the least of vessels, from bowls to all the jars. And then in verse 25, it refers to Shebna again. In that day, declares Yahweh of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will give way. This is Shebna. This is the day that God's going to give Shebna the sack and appoint Eliakim. That peg, which was driven in a firm place, will give way. It will even break off and fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut off, for Yahweh has spoken. Now, what's all this about? Well, Eliakim, the good steward, is described in two main ways in this passage. First, it says he's going to have the key to the house of David. I think we sang about this in one of our carols today, about the key. He's called the key of David or something. He's going to have the key to the house of David, in verse 22, put on his shoulder. This means that he was going to have authority over the king's household. The key to the house of David represents his governance or his rule. And the key speaks of the fact that only this man who had that key, in this case Eliakim, only he could open the doors and grant access to the king. Nobody had access to the king unless Eliakim opened the door for him with his key. No one had authority to open or shut the door to the king's presence except Eliakim. He granted access to the king, or he denied access to the king. And therefore, Eliakim is a type of the Lord Jesus Christ. Only Jesus can grant access to God's presence. And Jesus himself said, I am the door of the sheep. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved. He said that in John 10:7 and 9. And just like Eliakim, Jesus has the key to the government. He has the key of authority on his shoulder. Isaiah 9:6 says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder." This is why the idea of the key being on his shoulder, maybe they had it strapped on their shoulder or something. So firstly, Eliakim has the key of authority on his shoulder, which allows access to the king, just like Jesus. But secondly, in verse 22, Eliakim is described as a tent peg, and this is the bit that's kind of relevant to Zechariah chapter 10, meaning that he's going to be stable. He's going to be firm. He's going to be secure. He'll be reliable, unlike his predecessor, Shebna, whose tent peg's going to give way in verse 25. He wasn't reliable. His authority will collapse, as we saw in verse 25. But on Eliakim's tent peg is going to be hung, obviously figuratively speaking, valuable things. It says, verse 24, "So they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offspring and issue, all the least of vessels, from bowls to all the jars." And I said to you that in the central tent peg at that time, they would often hang their pots and pans, but they'd often hang things that look nice. Things that, you know, if you have a visitor, oh, that looks showing off their what they owned a bit, you know. And if we go back to, and this is similar to the Lord Jesus Christ. He is like the central tent peg, because without him, the structure would collapse. He is the foundation. We've seen the cornerstone, but he's also like the tent peg upon which the whole of God's program or plan is based. And furthermore, just like this tent peg in those times had all the things hanging on it, the glory of Israel and its royal house will be displayed on him. Now let's go back. Getting hot. Oh, it's okay. Leah. It's fine. No, don't give everyone's fine. Let's go back to Zechariah 6. 12 and 13. We looked at this weeks ago. He's talking about the branch here. He says, "Then you will say to him, thus says Yahweh of hosts, behold a man," obviously Jesus here, "whose name is Branch, and he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of Yahweh. Indeed, it is he who will build the temple of Yahweh, and he who will bear the splendor." This idea of bearing the splendor, bearing the glory, just like that tent peg that had things hanging on it, glorious things hanging on it. So, that's been quite a sidetrack, about the tent peg, but I hope you found that interesting. So that's why he's called a tent peg, and now he's called the bow of battle. That's quite straightforward. Thirdly, the coming Messiah is described as a battle bow. And here, he isn't being portrayed as a humble, lowly person riding on a donkey, as we saw in the previous chapter. He has a battle bow in his hands here. And if we just go forward to Zechariah 14:3, Zechariah is going to show us the Messiah fighting against the Antichrist and the nations of the world. Could you read that, Steve? Zechariah 14:3.
"Then Yahweh will go forth and fight against those nations as in the day when he fights on the day of battle."
Right, so that's right. So he's going to be fighting in a battle. He's going to have a battle bow. And then at the end of verse 4, continuing into verse 5, it says, "From them every good taskmaster, all of them together, and they will be as mighty men, treading down the enemy in the mire of the streets in battle." The Messiah is going to raise up true leaders from his people. It says from them, from Judah. The leaders he will appoint will not be false shepherds like the ones we read earlier. They're going to be good leaders. They're called taskmasters here. And they're going to be like mighty men. Unlike the false shepherds, these future leaders are going to be on the side of the people. They will care for them and they will even fight for them. So the Messiah is going to raise up leaders who will tread down the enemy in the mire of the streets in battle. The implication here is that after the enemy has been defeated, and I'm sure this is talking about end times here, the soldiers will be just left in the mud. They won't be given a proper burial. They'll just be left in the mire, in the mud of the streets, killed and left in the streets, which was a kind of shaming and a dishonouring thing to do. But Israel's leaders, the riders on horses will be put to shame, as I've just said. But verse 6, he's going to make the house of Judah mighty. He's going to save the house of Joseph. And he's going to give total victory at that time. And I'm sure that these verses, because they've not been fulfilled yet, they are talking about a time in the future when Jesus will return and fight for his people. And we see Jesus here described as the ultimate warrior leading his people in victory. And Zechariah's point, really implied here, is that the people have a choice. They can either listen to these false shepherds that we've heard about in the previous verses, or they can listen to Yahweh, the true shepherd. And if they continue to follow these false shepherds, you know, the pagan gods or the diviners or the false prophets, they're going to continue to be afflicted, as it said at the end of verse 2. They're wandering around like sheep. They're afflicted. They're going to have a bad life. But if they listen to the true shepherd, they're going to be victorious. You have this picture here of them treading down the enemy. That's a bit different than silly sheep wandering around not knowing where they are. If they listen to the true shepherd, they're going to be victorious in life. And we know that at his first coming, Jesus presented himself to his people as the good shepherd. Let's turn to John 10. I don't think we can do a study on true shepherd without looking at these verses. John 10, 1 to 15. It's a long section, but let's just look at it. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, he is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him, the doorkeeper opens. We had this idea about him being the key, didn't we? And he has access. To him, the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice. And he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he brings all his own out, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. A stranger they will never follow, but will flee from him because they do not know the voice of strangers. This figure of speech Jesus spoke to them, but they did not understand what those things were which he had been saying to them. So Jesus said to them again, "Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved, and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who is not the owner of the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches and scatters them, because he is a hired hand and is not concerned about the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me, even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep." Now, unfortunately, the Jews rejected their good shepherd. Therefore, his kingdom has been postponed. But in the remaining verses in Zechariah, in this chapter in Zechariah, we have a description of the kingdom which the good shepherd would have brought in if they had accepted him at his first coming. So now, the rest of the chapter, these verses are now going to relate to a time in the future to us even, not just the future to Zechariah, but even the future to us. Let's look at 6 and 7. Firstly, in 6 and 7, we have a description of the kingdoms that he's going to unite when he returns. Ursula, can you read 6 and 7 again for us? I think it's been read, hasn't it, Phil? Mm-hmm. Can you read those again, 6 and 7?
Yes. I will fortify the house of the Judah and the house of Joseph I will save. I will surely bring them back because I care about them. They will be as if I have never cast them away. Since I am the Lord, their God, I will answer them. The people of Ephraim will become like mighty soldiers. They will be glad like those who have wine. Their children will see this and rejoice. Their hearts will find joy in the Lord.
Thank you. Now, in these verses, we have a mention of Judah, right at the beginning, verse 6, which is the southern kingdom, and Joseph, which represents the northern kingdom. Now, we used to the southern kingdom be referred to as Judah, and the northern kingdom, we're used to it being referred to as either Israel or Ephraim. Now, why is the northern kingdom referred to as Joseph? I'll just have a bit of a detour here. Let me give you a bit of a background to explain this. When a man was dividing his land and wealth among his sons in biblical times, he usually gave the firstborn son a double portion. Usually the girls didn't get anything. So if a man had 12 sons, like Jacob, he would divide his inheritance into 13. And his firstborn would be given 2/13 of his father's inheritance. But in the case of Jacob, he decided that his eldest son, Reuben, who had slept with his concubine, meaning Jacob's concubine, he wasn't going to give him two portions of his inheritance, which he would have normally because he'd slept with his own concubine, okay? Instead, he was going to give another one of his sons, his youngest son, Joseph, those two portions. And Joseph would then be able to pass them on to his two sons, who were born to him in Egypt, and who were called Manasseh and Ephraim. So, the 10 tribes in the north are sometimes called Israel, as I've said. And sometimes they're called Ephraim. Now, they're called Ephraim because the area of the land given to the tribe of Ephraim, one of Joseph's sons, was bigger than that of the other tribes in the north. Now, this doesn't mean that Ephraim was shown favoritism when the land was divided up, because some land was more fertile than others. So if Ephraim had a lot of kind of mountains and hills, which wasn't very fertile, he was given a bigger land. But because his land was bigger in area, the north was often referred to as Ephraim also. But also, sometimes, not very frequently, the land in the north was referred to as Joseph, and I've just explained why. Because the land of his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, was in the north, and that's what we have here. And the division of the land into 10 tribes in the north and 2 tribes in the south had come about as a result of God's discipline. And what had happened to make God do such a thing? It used to be all one nation. Well, it was Solomon's fault. Solomon had started really well. When he became king, God told him he could ask for anything and God would give it to him. He told Solomon he would give him wisdom, but he would also... I'll start again. So, God told Solomon he could ask for anything, God would give it to him. And Solomon asked for wisdom to rule his people. And God was so impressed that he told Solomon that he would give him wisdom, but he will also give him great wealth and riches, because he hadn't asked for that, which would be the normal, kind of normal thing to ask for. And we know the story, how Solomon's wealth was so great that the Queen of Sheba came to marvel at his kingdom and his palace. But unfortunately, Solomon became enslaved by his many wives, whom he married, largely to make alliances and trading agreements with other lands. And his wives, most of whom were not Jews, led him astray so that he ended up worshipping pagan gods. Now let's turn to 1 Kings 11, 9 to 13. 1 Kings 11. This isn't really the main point of the message this morning, but it's just an interesting little piece of information which you may not totally be aware of. 1 Kings 11, 9 to 13. I'm going to read that. It's 2 Kings. That wouldn't be the right place at all. Right, now Yahweh was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from Yahweh, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not walk after other gods. But he did not keep what Yahweh had commanded. So Yahweh said to Solomon, because this has happened with you, you have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, so I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So God warns Solomon here because he'd gone astray. He says, I'm not going to tear the kingdom from you immediately. But after you've died, what's going to happen is your son is not going to have all the 12 tribes like you have had. I'm going to tear it from you, and I'm going to give, it was his servant was Jeroboam, and his own son was called Rehoboam. So his own son, Rehoboam, just had one tribe, because by this time the other tribe had been, the tribe of Simeon, by this tribe had been subsumed into the tribe of Judah. So it was really, although there were actually two tribes in the south, it's referred to as one tribe there. So that was a long digression. So let's get back to our text. So in verses 6 and 7, Yahweh promises to strengthen the house of Judah and to save the house of Joseph, which we've just determined are the ones in the north, the southern and northern kingdoms. And he's going to unite, he's going to secure and unite all the 12 tribes. And verse 7 says that Ephraim, the ones in the north, is going to be like a mighty man. And the tribes in the north didn't really have a reputation for being mighty men, because it was they who had been taken into captivity first. They'd been taken to Assyria and they never even came back. But now the promise is that it's going to be that they're going to return. And we're going to see this. First of all, they're going to be united. And now we're going to read about them being returned to the land. So, Phil, could you read 8 to the end, please?
I will whistle for them and gather them in, for I have redeemed them, and they shall be as many as they were before. Though I scattered them among the nations, yet in far countries they shall remember me, and with their children they shall live and return. I will bring them home from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria, and I will bring them to the land of Gilead and to Lebanon, till there is no room for them. He shall pass through the sea of troubles and strike down the waves of the sea, and all the depths of the Nile shall be dried up. The pride of Assyria shall be laid low, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart. I will make them strong in the Lord, and they shall walk in his name, declares the Lord.
Thank you. So these verses that have just been read describe the regathering of the Jews into the land of Israel under the Messiah's reign during end times. In verse 8, God says he's going to whistle for them. Now, in the Old Testament, well, in ancient Israel, shepherds used to whistle for their sheep. So this is, people would have understood this as talking in shepherds' kind of language. This is another allusion to God being their true shepherd. And it's referring here to a time in the future when all the Jews who are alive will turn in faith to their Messiah. Because it says here, for I have redeemed them. He's going to whistle for them, to gather them together in the land of Israel, and they will be all redeemed. All Israel will be redeemed, and there will be many of them. It says they will be as numerous as they were before. What is this before? Before what? Many commentators think he's referring to the time of Solomon. Before the kingdom split up, before the kingdom was divided. That was a very, very prosperous time in Israel's history during Solomon's reign. So Christ is going to bring his people back to the land of Israel, and there's going to be as many people in the land as there were, possibly referring to during that prosperous time, which was the reign of Solomon. But then something very strange here. Verse 9, to make sense of it, we've got to understand that it kind of backtracks chronologically. It describes something which will take place before verse 8. Before God whistles for them and gathers them, before he does that, and before he gathers his redeemed people back to Israel, which will take place at the end of the tribulation, before he whistles for them, we learn in verse 9 that they had previously been sown or scattered all over the world. We see here, it says, I will sow them among the nation, among the peoples. They have been sown, maybe some people have got scattered, among the peoples, a bit like a gardener might sow seeds. They're in far countries at this stage. They're growing in foreign nations all over the world, and they're waiting the time when they're going to be transplanted, to use this gardener's term, back into the land. Now, this can't be referring to the Babylonian exile, because we have a plural word here. It says, I will sow them among the peoples, plural. If it said the people, well, the Babylonian exile is actually been and gone and been done by the time Zechariah's writing. But it's talking about multiple peoples here. It wasn't just being taken to one nation. So this must be referring to their dispersion after AD 70. Because that was the time when they went all over the world. And it says, they will remember me in far countries. Now, right at the beginning of our studies, I said that the theme of this book is Yahweh remembers. And that is the meaning of Zechariah's name. That's what Zechariah means. Yahweh remembers. But here, verse 9, we don't have Yahweh remembering. We have the people remembering. And near the close of the tribulation, when the Jews have suffered great persecution from the Antichrist, they will remember their Messiah. They will remember the one who came 2,000 years ago to be their good shepherd, the one they rejected because they foolishly listened to the false shepherds at that time, who were the scribes and Pharisees at that time. And they, the false shepherds, the scribes and Pharisees, incited them to get Pilate to crucify their good shepherd. And at that time in the future, they're going to remember, they will remember that their good shepherd was willing to lay down his life for them, as we read in John 10. They will remember that their good shepherd was the suffering servant who Isaiah spoke about, the one who bore their griefs and sorrows, the one who was pierced for their transgressions and crushed for their iniquities. And they and their children, it says at the end of verse 9, will believe on him and live. You see that? They will live. In their act of believing and turning to their true shepherd, they will live. And then their good shepherd will return to earth, crush their enemies, and bring them back to the land. Now, last week, we read Matthew 24. Let's just turn to it again to make sure that's clear in our mind. Matthew 24, 29 to 31. Phil, could you read? Oh, maybe Lorna, actually, next. 29 to 31.
Immediately after the tribulation at those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give up its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then will appear in the heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on clouds of heaven with great power and glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other.
Right, and as we've said several times, the elect here are not the Calvinists, all right? They are Jews who have returned to their Messiah in faith. The elect here are Jews, all right? And they're not talking about the church age. So this is, in, if you like, verse 31, this is God whistling. He's whistling for them to come into the land. He's going to send forth his angels. They're going to bring his elect from the four winds where they've been scattered after this dispersion in AD 70. He's going to bring them back into the land. That is when they've turned to the Messiah in faith. And they're going to come back with their children. And it says in verse 10, I will cause them to return from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria. And this mentions two of the countries they will return from. Only two here, it mentions. And I think Zechariah has chosen these two countries deliberately to make a point. Firstly, let's consider Egypt. Now, verse 11 here, just moving forward here, it describes the believing Jews, it describes their return in terms of their first return. It says they will pass through the Sea of Distress, which is referring to the Red Sea, and he will strike the waves in the sea. That's a reference to when God parted the sea, when the Hebrews crossed over the Red Sea. So Zechariah is talking about a future return from the land of Egypt, and he's describing it in terms of the first time that the Hebrews came from Egypt. Why is he doing that? Well, the Exodus was a very important moment in the nation's history. It marked the beginning of the nation, actually. And here he's describing, if you like, a second Exodus from Egypt. And this is going to mark the beginning of the millennial kingdom. So this is why I think he refers to Egypt. The people coming out of Egypt is a kind of poignant idea that people are going to come out of Egypt a second time to come into the millennial kingdom. And secondly, he chooses the country of Assyria. And I think that choice is significant also because the 10 tribes in the north were taken into exile by the Assyrians, but they never came back. And in fact, people often refer to them as the 10 lost tribes. As far as God is concerned, they're not lost. He knows who the people are from those tribes and who their, who their progeny are. He knows where they are and who they are. And we can be pretty sure they're not who the Mormons say they are. You know, that the Mormons have based their whole religion on the claim that the 10 tribes of Israel are the American Indians. That's the whole basis of their religion. If we turn to Hosea 11, 10 and 11, we see Hosea saying the same thing as Zechariah. Hosea 11, 10 and 11. Can you read that, Steve, if you've got it?
Yeah.
I know you've got a new Bible.
Hosea
11. Yeah, 11.
10 and 11. They will walk after Yahweh. He will roar like a lion. Indeed, he will roar. And his sons will come trembling from the west. They will come trembling like birds from Egypt, and like doves from the land of Assyria, and will settle them, and I will settle them in their houses, declares Yahweh.
Right, this is talking about the same time. Hosea is talking about the same thing here, and he is using this the same two examples of Egypt and Assyria as two lands that they're going to come from. This is talking about end times also. And if we go back to Zechariah, it says here near the end of verse 11, and the pride of Assyria will be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt will depart. So these were ancient enemies of Israel, Assyria, who took them into captivity, did terrible things to them. They're going to receive their comeuppance. God is going to deal with them. And the scepter of Egypt will depart. In other words, they're not going to be ruling any longer. But those two countries are not the only countries that the Jews are going to return to. Let's go to a return from. Those are the ones they're not the only countries they're going to return from. Let's go to Isaiah 11, where we get a fuller list. I think Zechariah just chosen those to make a point. I'll read Isaiah 11, 10 to 16, 10 to the end. Again, talking about the same time, the end. Then it will be in that day, which often usually refers to the end times, that the nations will seek the root of Jesse. We know that's the Jesus. Who will stand as a standard for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. Probably talking about his throne, where he'll be ruling from Jerusalem. Then it will be in that day that the Lord will again acquire the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain. Now these are some of the places they're going to come from. From Assyria, Egypt, those two mentioned first, Pathros, Ethiopia, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the coastlands of the sea. A lot of people think the coastlands of the sea refers to, I don't know, areas like Spain and the UK, even America. That's a bit fanciful, but further outlying areas, in other words. And he will lift up a standard for the nations and assemble the banished ones of Israel, and will gather the scattered, those that have previously been scattered, of Judah, from the four corners of the earth. Then the jealousy of Ephraim will depart, and those who assail Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not assail Ephraim. So here we have a clear picture of Ephraim in the north, Judah in the south. There's not going to be any enmity anymore. They're going to be united. And they will swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west. Together they will plunder the sons of the east. They will stretch out their hands over Edom and Moab, and the sons of Ammon will obey them. And Yahweh will devote to destruction the tongue of the sea of Egypt, and he will wave his hand over the river, that's the river Euphrates, with his scorching wind, and he will strike it into seven streams and make men walk over dry shod. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of his people who will remain, just as there was for Israel in the day that they came up out of the land of Egypt. So those verses are referring to other places besides Assyria and Egypt that God is going to bring his the Jews, who are now going to be believing. And it says there are going to be so many believing Jews who return at the start of Jesus' millennial reign. It says at the end of verse 10, he's going to bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon until no room can be found from them. Well, Gilead is a region in the northeast of Israel, and Lebanon is a country northwest of Israel. Now, technically, at the moment, both of these areas are outside present-day Israel. But in the millennial kingdom, these areas will belong to Israel and will be inhabited by believing Jews. And Zechariah mentions those areas to show that at that time the Jews are going to be so numerous, who've come back into the land and believing in the Lord Jesus, their Messiah, that they're going to be spilling over into the neighbouring regions. They're going to fill the land until no room can be found for them. And then verse 12 closes the chapter with the promise that at that time the believing Jews will be strong in faith and obedient to Yahweh. So in this chapter, we've had a contrast, only hinted, I must admit, in this chapter, it's going to be developed more in the next, a contrast between two types of spiritual leader. We had the political leaders in the previous chapter, now we're going on to the spiritual leaders, the shepherds. We've had the false shepherds, whom God has castigated, and then we've seen Israel's true shepherd, Yahweh. And it's also told us quite a lot about the wonderful things God would have done if they had accepted Jesus as their good shepherd. They would have been strong, both politically and spiritually. They would have been prosperous. The divided kingdoms of Judah in the south and Ephraim in the north would have been united. They would not have been dispersed under the Romans in AD 70. But unfortunately, at Jesus' first coming, the people followed the false shepherds, the scribes and Pharisees, and rejected the good shepherd. So now all these wonderful promises have been postponed. They won't be fulfilled in the church age. Instead, God is waiting for Israel to turn to her good shepherd. Only then will these promises be fulfilled.